previously.tv podcast network.
You gotta come back to camp.
I left camp behind years ago. When I was fired.
What did you expect would happen, Gene? You went rogue. The menu would say grilled cheese and you'd make a taco. Or the menu would say hamburgers and you'd make a taco. Or the menu would say chicken soup and you'd make
tacos! I know what I did!
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 166 for the week of August 7th, 2017. I am Urine Soak Diorama David T. Cole, and I'm here with mulleted sex coach Sarah D. Bunting.
Get on in there.
Autofillated can Tara Ariano.
That's right, Gene. I can suck my own dick.
And deviated septum surgical repair expert Adam Sternberg.
I can breathe!
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Before we get into today's episode, I have two pieces of site business. Site business, the first. Next week's episode is a mega dose of Fuck, Marry, Kill, and we need your suggestions. So you will give us your triplets for Fuck, Marry, Kill. You will give Sarah one, you will give Tara one, you will give me one, and you will give guest Jeff Drake one. And you can send those to us at previously.tv/FMK. So that's going to be next week, 1 week from today. Site business point number two. We are a little bit delayed on Extra Hot Game Time. Our game master, Rob Hartman, had a little bit of real life stuff happened, but we're on track now for a September debut. We did get all of your submissions, your applications, and that is going, but we thought we would be starting in August, but it looks like it's September now. So that is site business. And now on with the show. Tara.
Please welcome our guest after a long absence. Remember that show, Rake? He came on to talk about it. It's our friend, Adam Sternberg. Hey, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
Hello, Rake.
Yay!
Thanks for having me back.
We needed to take a long break, apparently. That show, Rake, no one remembers it except as Steak Face, possibly, from the ads with Greg Kinnear with steak on his face. But we are not here to talk about Rake or Steak Face today. We are here to talk about Wet Hot American Summer 10 years later, which just dropped on Netflix, 8 episodes on Friday. And I have a thought on this, which is it should, if they're going to keep doing this, and I'm not opposed to them doing that, they should go back to movies because, wow, 8 episodes of this felt very bloated to me. Adam, what were your thoughts?
I don't disagree with you. I have a question, though. Mm-hmm. So I saw the original Wet Hot American Summer in the theater in 2001.
With us. Yeah.
You, yes, yeah. Exactly.
Including so, Sarah, because she lived in Toronto at that time.
Yeah.
It's sort of thematically appropriate because I felt like seeing that movie in the theater, and then I'm watching this now, however, what is it, 16 years later. Mm-hmm. I'm like the campers in the show coming back. I look about as good as the campers in the show. I look as much older than I did then. You know, I feel like the normal yardsticks to the show sort of don't apply because does this need to be 8 episodes? Probably not. Does it need to be 1 episode? Not really.
Yeah.
Like the fact, but I appreciate the fact that Netflix has sort of taken on this strange Medici-like role of not just creating sort of standard television, but just acting as this deep-pocketed patron for these kind of crazy projects that don't seem to have any like real commercial reason to exist, but clearly there's like a cult following for this movie and for the previous series that was on Netflix. And so I'm sort of like, I'm happy that they're doing it in theory. Was I as happy when I was watching all 8 episodes? I mean, they're only half an hour each. It's very hit and miss, which was sort of my thought about the movie, to be honest. You know, that there's moments that are really, really funny and then there's everything else. But if they can get Paul Rudd and They did not get Bradley Cooper for this go-around. But if they can get, you know, Amy Poehler and all the people, Chris Maloney, and together again, I would probably watch the next one, too.
Yeah, Sarah, so would I.
Go ahead. I was just about to throw it to you, and then you took it anyway. Please proceed.
That's what I do. I'm grabby. I agree that it did not need to be eight. I'm not sure they could get all of the stuff that I enjoyed into another like hour and a half or 2 hours, but it didn't need to be eight, five, six. Like the stuff that worked really worked. And I like barked laughing a couple of times, but there's some stuff that's clearly like, well, I'm a producer and this shit stays in. And what I'm talking about is the fucking interminable Reagan Bush subplot that did not pay off well. And here's the thing. Going back to the movie, this franchise has made a whole point of like doing these knowing winks about how whole action movies that are supposed to take place over the course of like 3 months have been fit into an hour. Mm-hmm. Like their whole drug bender with the Rick Springfield song. And then they're like, it's great to get away from camp, even if it's only for an afternoon or whatever it is they say. And it's like, dude, just shortcut it that way. Who cares? Like it doesn't actually... You don't actually have to do the whole, like, well, here, now it's lunchtime. Like, well, okay, you don't have to do that. With that said, if they continue, even if they don't sort of tighten it up, I find enough to enjoy that. And the new cast additions, like Mark Feuerstein, who, speaking of not aging, Jesus.
Yeah.
I thought he was great. His wig was fucking glorious. yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. But it could be shorter. I would have been happier with it at five and with way less like just Showalter's Reagan taking a dump on a diorama. Like, I don't, that's not that funny.
Yeah, Reagan wasn't good on the last season and they kind of doubled down on it this season. And that was a bad choice. But you know what? I think this season just lacked energy overall. I mean, I think when this series shined was when it got super zany. You know, like the can fight in the trailer between Gene.
Oh God, that was the best part. Yeah. The best. And the car chase. Loved
it. And the waitress. The can and the waitress. Yes. Like a side of your buns. Like that stuff was great. And I think that's where this series is at its best, at least post movie. But the rest of it, like I even thought compared to last season, like a lot of the cast members were just seemed to be like spinning their wheels. Things just kind of didn't really go anywhere. Like the only real plot I thought that kind of had a payoff, because there's a lot of like who's hooking up with whose stuff and none of it actually works out. I thought the only one that really paid off was the Alyssa Milano nanny storyline.
Yeah. Yes.
Which started off pretty conventionally, like breaking down, deconstructing the tropes of that sort of movie. And this, like, you know, there's a person whispering to the dad who had hired the nanny that, oh, you know, you're going to call the agency and they're not going to have anybody working under that name. But then there's like an actual genuine payoff beyond that typical joke cycle. And that was really great. And that actually made the ending kind of fantastic. Overall, I think like you're writing a story about people getting older and more boring. It's really hard not to make your show more boring. This season was definitely more boring. And I thought that the season just seemed really kind of like low energy, low key at times. And I was like, well, when are they, you know, going to kick it up? And it was really only Mitch and Gene that I thought really consistently brought that.
Yeah, I wondered how much of that was a factor of they only had certain people for certain days, sort of like Netflix's Arrested Development season, that they had to tailor that to how much, like, it seemed like there were a lot of reaction shots of Paul Rudd by himself. So I wondered if he was only there for like 2 days or something.
And Amy Poehler's like whole storyline was siloed.
Yes. Although her showdown with John Early as Logan in the theater, that was one of my favorite scenes too, when they have that fight and then pretend it's a scene. John Early is just, he's so great. Bringing him in on this was a good idea. But yeah, it seems to me it's more like, you know, it's like the Ocean's movies, which I also love, but certainly they do seem like they are only made because the people that do them like to do it, as opposed to like that there's much commercial reason for it. I mean, I definitely liked a lot of things about this, and there were a lot of moments that I thought were good. I agree with you about the nanny storyline, but the reason I think a movie would be better is that, like, while we were watching the last two episodes last night, I just was struck by, like, remembering the movie, which really only has kind of two through line stories, which are Coop and Katie and Star Lab, the stuff with the indoor kids and David Hyde Pierce, who, by the way, his cameo was great too.
Oh, they, God, like, it was perfect.
Clearly shooting it in his actual study. So at the end, he, like, gets up and takes an Emmy and leaves, like, peels off his mustache. It's so good.
So good.
Yeah. The Emmys in the background of his little Skype cameo was probably my favorite moment.
I thought that was so good, but yeah,
and I actually was a little bummed that they, like, hit it up, that they sort of hit it on the nose when he at the end when he's walking out. But because that was great. And then there's that little moment when he sort of says, thanks, let me know if you need anything else. And it sounds like it's probably the thing he really said.
Yeah.
Skype.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this just seemed like it was too full of stories that they felt like they had to sustain because there was so much more time. Whereas what makes the movie good isn't the story. It's just, like, the sketches, you know, that are all strung together. So I wonder if they had less time to fill, if it would feel tighter. That's all.
Yeah. No, I see what you're saying. I also thought that Deegs was a little bit underused. Mm. Like, I get that Paul Rudd probably was on set for, like, a day and a half. But that seemed like a sort of, I don't know, that seemed like a more interesting through line, frankly, than Coop and Katie. Like, I just kind of can't with Coop anymore. Please be too important for the next one. Because
did you care at all or spend any time thinking at all about the sort of suggestion at the end that everything we've just watched is perhaps just what's in Cooper's imagined novel, and that in fact their real lives are very boring and the reunion is actually quite normal and this has all been sort of concocted?
I don't know if I have the energy to produce headcanon for Wet Hot American Summer, frankly.
Yeah, that did occur to me, but I was sort of, like, distracted by the fact that, like, nobody puts Linsky in a corner, basically. Like, I just wish we'd been able to see more of her, and that was too bad. But yeah, no, that did occur to me that we were in the, like, snow globe.
Yeah. I think the future of this franchise lies in some sort of anthology or a spinoff scenario.
I would 100% watch a spinoff series, maybe a limited series, about the Chris Pine and Jason Schwartzman.
Yeah.
Them, like, having weird bionic man adventures with their, you know, interchangeable limbs and bionic eyes and stuff.
Mitch, Chris Pine, Gene, like, these are all ways they could go. And even if it's just, like, half an hour in and out, done, like, that works too. Like, I think those characters lend themselves to more of that sort of Netflix Arrested Development season 4 filming schedule than I think they just have to lean into it, though.
Yeah.
Rather than try to make it seem like they're all in this camp together when they're not, perhaps actually just have them go off in their separate adventures.
Yeah.
Like what happened in between seasons or the film in the first season.
Yeah, it could be like that Netflix does have a show called The Characters, which the aforementioned John Early has an episode of, where it's just each one is sort of a series of sketches with one performer and it doing a bunch of different things. So they could do something like that with these characters for sure. It's, you know, it's a deep bench of with a lot of talent.
Well, sounds like we're all saying there's laughs to be had, but maybe in less time or tighten it up.
Yep. Agree. Yeah.
Yep.
We have a message for April.
Emily let us know April is about to celebrate both a birthday and a new job and wanted us to help her celebrate.
According to Emily, she and April are, and I quote, giant dorks who watch TV over the phone together. So with that in mind, we made a list of TV phones April should not use for these phone-assisted TV chats.
Number 1, Frank Underwood's phone from House of Cards. That thing is loaded with shady spy software.
Number 2, Maxwell Smart's shoe phone from Get Smart. Too smelly. Based on the birthday you're celebrating, ask your grandparents.
Number 3, Sydney Bristow's Nokia from Alias. It's fine for dialing out, but every time it rings, you know you're just getting called to go on a mission and, therefore, away from your TV.
Number 4, the Flintstones phone from Springfield Elementary that Bart enjoyed so much when he was temporarily sent back to kindergarten. It's fun, but it's just a toy.
Yabba dabba doo, I like talking to you.
Exactly.
And number 5, Zach Morris's infamous cell phone from Saved by the Bell, primarily because lifting that thing could seriously injure your back.
from all of us here and Emily, happy birthday and happy new job, April.
It's time to go around the dial. First stop, Tara.
I watched the premiere last week of The Sinner, which is a new limited series, or so they say, hashtag under the dome, hashtag still mad, on USA. This, you may have seen the ads for it if you live in a major metropolitan city with Jessica Biel looking roll wet. What happens in the pilot is she is a housewife and a mother, and she goes to the beach with her husband, and some young people on the blanket in front of her are horsing around, including a guy sort of picking up his girlfriend and like fake flirty wrestling with her while this weird song plays. And Jessica Biel's character, whose name is Cora, takes the knife that she's been using to cut up a pear for her kid and goes and stabs this guy to death. Like, really, it's quite graphic what she does. Like, she's goes straight for the throat. It's very efficient. And so the story is about why she did this to this person that she doesn't know. It seems pretty obvious after the first episode that we're going to find out she was triggered. This is just my speculation. I don't know anything and I haven't watched ahead, that she was triggered by this song and she possibly knew this guy or someone who really looked like him. And she was sexually assaulted in her youth while this song was playing. This seems obvious, so I hope it's not that, but I think it probably will be. And so so far the story is, women don't do stuff like this. And so there's a lot of profiling nonsense. Bill Pullman is the detective on the case with a big giant beard and his own weird sexual fetishes that we also see in the season premiere, which seems unnecessary, but happens. Sarah, did you watch this? I wondered if you did because it was a crime show.
I was considering it because it seemed like a why done it, but it also seemed like maybe it seemed like it would be interesting. Mm-hmm. But then I just feel like Biel has been sort of everywhere. Like, she's on the cover of a lot of things. And I feel like we're sort of being asked to, like, Jessica Biel, you didn't appreciate her on Seventh Heaven. Like, well, I didn't appreciate most things on Seventh Heaven, mm-hmm. but trying to tell me that she was like an underappreciated thespian, like, no, sorry.
Right.
And so I was already kind of, I was just saturated with her.
Yeah.
Already. So I didn't try it. Should I? It doesn't sound like I should.
I mean, it's so far in the killing mode. So if that's your jam, you might like it. Like, it looks like it's going to be a slow show that's only about this one case and possibly only for however long the first season is. Like, I don't even know, 6 or 8 or 13 or whatever. But, you know, we've all been burned by these allegedly limited series before. And I can certainly see some kind of environment where someone decides, we've got Bill Pullman, let's keep him, you know. And he's got to be capitalizing now because he's the only Bill Blanken that is still with us. RIP Bill Paxton. But yeah, it's fine. You know, I'm probably going to keep watching it. So I don't know. I guess I can tell you if I bail out. This has been your extremely average procedural show report. USA is not really known for this. We'll see if this is a new lane that they can get into. I will say it's already outpaced Spike's adaptation of The Mist, which I only got one episode through. So, you know, there's that. I guess I like Bill Pullman more than I would have thought. And for my plug, I will mention Two Old Hookers, the Catfish podcast that Sarah and I do. Catfish is doing another clip show this week, but we will be back with a new episode next Wednesday. That'll be the 16th. Yes.
Adam Sternberg, what do you got?
Well, my other viewing that I was doing, my non-wet hot American summer viewing recently, I have been watching the Netflix show Ozark, which I understand you've discussed previously, but I'm here to present the counter argument for the show. And I'm only about 3 episodes into it, but I am actually quite enjoying it. And I have to admit that I was very much looking forward to this show because I like the idea of Jason Bateman as a dramatic lead. I thought he was really interesting in The Gift. And also, to be even more contrarian, the guy who created the show, the writer who wrote the pilot, this guy Bill Dubuque, also wrote The Accountant, a movie that I have a certain fondness for.
Yeah.
Which we can discuss at another time.
I totally understand that. And Adam, do you know they're making a sequel to The Accountant?
Oh my gosh, what is it called?
I don't know yet. We were speculating, but
The Audit? Yeah.
No, The Return. File Your Return.
Nice.
Yes.
Well done.
I knew a little bit about Ozark going into it. I watched the first few episodes. Then I went online to see sort of what the critical consensus was. And I was not too surprised at the sort of criticisms that seem to be common, that it seems familiar and it seems a little bit like a kind of designer imposter perfume version of Breaking Bad. But you know what? I really like Breaking Bad and they're not making it anymore. So I'm happy to spray on a little Ozark now. I like the smell. And I'm interested to see where it goes. So don't spoil it for me. I was talking to someone recently who is about the same number of episodes into it. And he was like, so Laura Linney's going to do more, right? Like she's got to do something more in the show. And I'm kind of hoping she's going to go like full Lady Macbeth before it's over. But, this is my endorsement of Ozark. This is my pro Ozark, argument or Prozark. Mm-hmm. Listen to Prozark.
Yep.
Wow. Netflix, there's your pull quotes. You got Prozark and you got spray on some Ozark. I mean, I don't know how you can not be pitching this to the whole
world. We will wait our
check. You can really smell the Ozark.
Adam, I would also recommend Claws if you're missing Breaking Bad. This is my weekly recommendation of Claws. Everyone has to watch it.
Claws, show of the summer,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
Breaking Bad in the nail salon world, is that
yes.
it?
Yes.
Breaking Bad meets Justified in the nail salon world.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
As you can tell from my Prozark pitch, I'm into things that are sort of dark and crimey and thrillery and vaguely Breaking Bad influenced, maybe, if you squint. And along those lines, I have a new novel, which just came out on August 1st, called The Blinds, about a remote Texas town that is not what it seems. A little bit of a penal colony. There's a bunch of criminals there, except twist, they've all had their memories of their criminal pasts erased. They're trying to start fresh. And you can guess how well that goes.
Cool premise.
So it's a lot of fun. It's good. And
I started the audiobook, and it is good. Adam, if it's not like it's not a big spoiler or anything like that, but can you explain what happens, how the characters get their names? Like, I thought that was really cool.
Oh, thanks. Yes, this can be junior plug, because so the idea is everyone who arrives doesn't know anything about their own pasts, or at least the most sordid parts of their pasts. And so they have to pick a new name. And in order to have some uniformity in the names, and also so you don't pick a name that would subconsciously give away some element of your past, the rule is you pick a name that's a combination of a movie star and a vice president. So the sheriff in the town is named Calvin Cooper. From Gary Cooper and Calvin Coolidge. And there's a character named Errol Colfax. And this is how everyone in the town gets their names. And what my publisher kindly did to indulge me is they actually created a website where you too can create your own name for the blinds. There's a blinds name generator. It's at welcometotheblinds.com.
Love it.
And you can generate your own name. The first time I did it, I got the name Harry Harlow, which is a pretty awesome
wow.
name.
Wow.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
We'll link that in the show notes, too.
It's a little distracting. Yeah. Also, if you're thinking of, you know, fleeing the continental U.S. and leaving your past behind.
Who would ever find someone named Spiro Van Buren? Come on.
Oh, I just went to there and I just did it. It gave me Spencer Chaney.
Oh, nice.
Ouch.
Oh, wait. Oh, here's a good one. Harpo Wheeler. That's
yes.
it. That's the one.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, now I have to do it too.
Move ahead.
Catherine Dallas. How did it know I'm a lady? But it did.
Wow. Nice.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. So if you guys like something a little dark and structured, like it's got this great sort of nerdy structure to it too, which I enjoy so far. So I can also recommend it two chapters in. First two chapters, excellent. Rest of it, I don't know. I can't speak to it, Adam. But the first
you
two chapters.
You can revisit it in a future show.
Congratulations, yes. Adam, on publication.
Thank you.
Yes, congratulations, Adam. I am here to talk about Intervention. It is back for season 19, which I feel like maybe they skipped a couple seasons. Like A&E's numbering of these seasons is very mysterious and possibly heroin induced. It's interesting to see the show sort of not evolving along the lines of it or anything, but as the opioid crisis, which, if I'm not mistaken, our president is allegedly trying to string together a bunch of words in English about as we are recording this. good luck to us all. As the opioid crisis is getting more and more, like, it's still gathering steam and it's becoming something that everyone is much more aware of, this show's sort of place in that constellation of pain, for lack of a better word. The season premiere was disheartening as to the subject, but did a check-in with a guy from last season who is now a sober coach. He was one of the more charming subjects in my time watching the show, which is forever. His name is Sturgill. He finally has a decent haircut and isn't picking at his face and seems to have found his calling. And it's very heartening to see that. And also that they tend to do check-ins with people who had relapses or have not gone sort of in a straight line, which is just how it is in that life. And I think that's great and very compassionate, which is the show's great strength. This past week, the one that aired as we're recording this last night, was one of the rare subjects of color. I'm not really sure why it is that the show is so white. I mean, I don't think it says anything about the show. It's just interesting to me. But you can tell the show is like not pivoting, but sort of acknowledging that this is really a sort of countrywide crisis and that the show now is not nearly the like outlier, like sort of driving past a train wreck situation that it was. Now this is many, many, many people's lives and fears. So that's interesting. It's not fun, but it's on and it's back. For more fun, please listen to our Great British Bake Off podcast, Two Spotted Dicks, one of the hosts of whom, Danny, will be on my music podcast with our frequent guest, Mark Blankenship.
Hey.
So it will be Damastis. Danny and Mark and Sarah talk about songs, specifically Bryan Adams, a Canadian, for episode 69, because we're exactly that classy.
Nice.
Strap in, guys.
Lansky's beauties celebrate when Nancy gets a job at the top.
First days are liable to be a little hectic.
Well, the job's easy. It's the furniture that's going to kill me.
Then Bernice plans a trip on Fish's 38th wedding anniversary.
This is the first time I've had my own bathroom for months.
And Murder leads Starsky and Hutch to a dancing school. Then the cop of the future impersonates a card shark to set up a poker ring.
Cool.
Future cop, right after Lansky's beauties, Fish, and Starsky and Hutch.
Saturday starting at 8, 7 Central and Mountain on ABC.
Yay, that's real. Wow. Everything about that is real. Does anybody know about Future Cop? This is a show that I did not know about until yesterday. Future Cop, no. Anybody?
That is so in my wheelhouse, and I'm amazed that I have never heard of it.
I love that the clip is one word, call. Like, okay, got it.
Future Cop, I don't know who actually plays Future Cop, but his street partner buddy, Ernest Borgnine. And also another cop, I believe, maybe the sergeant, I'm not sure, John Amos, the father from Good Times, is also in this. And Future Cop looks sort of like prototype almost human. He looks human. He's just got, he lifted up his stomach and he pasted some circuit boards to his tummy, basically.
Harlan Ellison sued ABC over this show.
Oh, really?
Alleging that Future Cop was plagiarized from their own pitch for a TV series, which was based on their 1970 short story Brillo. That's Harlan Ellison and Ben Bova.
Wow.
The suit was settled and they got a few hundred grand in compensatory damages.
Oh, good for them. For my pitch, I don't think I talked about this since it went up, but that's what we're talking about. My miscellaneous Star Wars podcast is now up. First two episodes have been delivered. Our first episode was with none other than our guest here today, Adam Sternberg, and I'm going to play you a 1 minute or so clip because this is Adam's favorite part of the episode, where just after we were talking about the puzzling holo chess board Cirque du Soleil segment in which there are forest nymphs dancing and all sorts of French Canadian meets space craziness going on, I subjected him to a test of how long he could last through the music that accompanied set. And have a listen, won't you?
It is so weird. I was watching it and I literally couldn't believe what I was seeing.
I have a challenge for you. And that is this. You yell when you cannot take the holo song challenge. I'm going to start playing it. If you can last the whole 2 minutes.
Can I have a safe word?
Yeah, you just shout something out and we'll end it. Your safe word is... you yell, "Let the Wookiee win," and then we'll end it. Here we go. Holo song challenge brought to you by Moog synthesizers of the 70s and our favorite garden forest nymph man. Holo song challenge. Lasted about 25 seconds.
Oh, well, I was having horrifying flashbacks of what's actually happening during that meeting.
That was part one of a seven part look at the Star Wars Holiday Special. I had to chop it up into little bits to keep my sanity and to keep the sanity of my guests. So that's what we're talking about. Available at previously.tv and on all your podcast apparati.
And the aforementioned Daniel McEachern, who's also going to be a masked ass, was your second guest, we should say.
And I will be coming up soon. God help me.
It is time for another canon pitch this week. Adam Sternberg, take it away, Adam.
All right. Well, as you three know, I have a somewhat checkered history with the canon. I have proposed 3 different episodes for the canon, and I think my batting average is 1 for 3. I had originally proposed an episode of Police Squad, which was not voted in. I proposed an episode of The Office, the UK edition, Represent, that was voted in, and then an episode of Firefly that was turned down. So in coming back before you all to present another canon selection, I will admit my initial impulse was to just pick something that I thought would be a surefire winner. Some Breaking Bad episode that hasn't yet been inducted, or some lost Simpsons episode, or something like that. But then I decided to go in the exact opposite direction, strap myself into my kamikaze plane, and fly myself into the ocean. I had been thinking a lot after watching Wet Hot American Summer about the idea of comedy, and in particular, TV comedy, and the way that comedy ages over the years, and why it is that, especially on TV, it feels like it's very hard to go back and watch comedies from yesteryear and really appreciate what made them funny. So I chose a classic episode of the classic comedy, The Honeymooners. No, I'm kidding. I chose an episode of Three's Company because I was determined to make this, the degree of difficulty on this, as high as possible. So the episode I chose is called Up in the Air. It's from season 6 of Three's Company. For those of you who don't remember Three's Company, it was one of the iconic sitcoms of the 70s. It starred John Ritter and Joyce DeWitt, and in its later seasons, Priscilla Barnes. As John Ritter starred as Jack Tripper, he was a single bachelor man about town who, through a series of hilarious mishaps, came to live with 2 single women in 1 apartment. And in a kind of anachronistic twist in the show, he had to pretend that he was gay so that the landlords of the building would allow him to live with these women. If you've ever seen Three's Company, which I'm sure everyone listening to this has, unless you're too young to remember it, it essentially was sort of a TV sitcom version of a French farce. A lot of slamming doors, a lot of overheard conversations that were misunderstood, a lot of double entendres, and a lot of people falling down and tripping over things. Three's Company was also probably my favorite television show in the first, I would say, 14 years of my life. I remember as a kid watching comedies on TV that I knew I was supposed to like, that my older brother really liked, like Barney Miller and MASH, which are classic shows and which I certainly came to appreciate later. But the show that made me laugh the most was Three's Company. So I was really interested to go back and watch the one episode that I remember being the absolute funniest one of all, which is Up in the Air. And I was interested in going back to look at it, that it's not just my recollection of it being one of the best. It was apparently John Ritter's favorite episode. It was in the season for which John Ritter won an Emmy for Best Male Lead in a Comedy, and is often cited as one of the best, if not the best, episodes of Three's Company, which I know sounds like a little bit of an oxymoron. So here's the plot summary for the episode, which will be the shortest plot summary in the history of canon proposals. Janet has been invited to a party by a rich dude who she's sort of interested in, but he's bringing a date. So Janet and Terry agree that she should also bring a date to make the rich dude jealous, and they decide that Jack should stand in as her date. He's all game for this until he finds out that the party is a very exclusive party that's being held on a private island, and they have to fly in an airplane to get there. So the first clip I think we should do, which I asked Dave to cut, is just a short little sample of the iconic theme song of the show, just to put us in the mood. I feel like I should point out that that theme song is actually the second version of the theme song on the show, that in the latter years, they added a sort of Waka Waka porn movie baseline to it. It's a little bit different than the original theme song. So I have to admit, I went back to rewatch this episode, which I remember being very funny, and it started off very unpromisingly. There's some real clunker jokes right off the top, which kind of remind you how much comedy and specifically sitcom writing has changed in the, I don't know, 35 years since this show aired. There's a moment at the beginning where Janet walks in and Terry says, "How was your day?" And she goes, "Fine, great. If I felt any better, I'd throw myself under a truck." And then the audience laughs. There's a joke early on where Jack and his friend Larry, who's the kind of lascivious used car salesman who lives in their building, Larry reveals to Jack that he has tranquilizers. And he says, "Why do you have tranquilizers?" And Larry says, "Who needs tranquilizers more than a used car salesman?" And Jack says, "Your customers," which has a little bit of a Bazooka Joe tang to it. But so in the opening moments of the show, I thought, oh my God, I've made a terrible mistake. This is going to be a disaster. And then there is this exchange between Janet and Jack, who I think are far and away the most, that Joyce DeWitt and John Ritter were the most talented people on the show. The third in the trio started out as Suzanne Summers, and then she got too big for the show and was replaced, and they went through a couple replacements and ended up with Priscilla Barnes, who I think is actually quite funny, but plays absolutely no role in this episode at all. She's basically in the first scene and in the button at the end. But there's this exchange between Janet and Jack where she reveals to him that they're going to have to fly, and he reveals to us that he is deathly afraid of flying. And this was the moment in rewatching the episode where I realized, wait a second, there is sitcom DNA here, important sitcom DNA that is the same DNA that you would see later in shows like Cheers, that you would see in Seinfeld. This is the kind of exchange, even though the delivery style and stuff feels a little bit dated and from the era, It's two very talented comedians doing what comedians do on sitcoms, which is taking their character and then taking a joke and kind of milking it for all it's worth. John Ritter's delivery in that exchange is actually kind of perfect. So the first act ends on this very kind of corny button joke where Jack has got his hands on some tranquilizers from Larry because he's too afraid to fly to the party. Janet says, absolutely not. You cannot take any tranquilizers. You have to promise me you won't
Terry
take
does.
One.
Yeah, I thought it was Terry because she's a nurse. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. So the line is, promise me you won't take one of those tranquilizers. And then Terry leaves the room and Jack says, I won't.
Yes.
I'll take two. Applause break. Go to commercial. End act one. Very 1970s three camera sitcom. Then we get to the next part of the show, which is the sort of extended second act, which is where this episode really sets itself apart, not only from your typical Three's Company episode, but I think from your typical 1970s/1980s sitcom episode. Janet and Jack arrive at the party. Jack is obviously impaired in a kind of goofy way. He reveals to Janet that he took a tranquilizer. She gets quite freaked out. It's a very fancy party. There's finance people and fancy pants, you know, 1970s TV version of fancy pants, which is like old women with long gloves on. And she tells him he can't have a drink and he promises he's not going to have a drink. And they meet a few people at the party and Jack is kind of being a goof and Janet interacts with the rich guy who's there with his date, who we already can sort of intuit is actually his sister. And Janet's trying to figure out how to get in with him. And Jack's trying to figure out how to get through the party, given that he's doped up on these tranquilizers. And at one, every time he meets someone, he tells them he has a different job. And so the first people he meets, he tells them he's a Jesuit priest, which is a callback to this book that Terry was reading in the beginning of the show. He tells someone else he's a congressman. He tells someone else he's a brain surgeon. And at one point, one of the sort of jackhole finance dudes comes over when Janet is not there to watch over Jack and gives him this big drink and tells him to drink it, which is our next clip. So Jack drinks this big gulp of sort of unknown origin. It's never really revealed in the show whether it was a big alcoholic drink or not, but he kind of goes, it's like a cartoon where the, you know, red water rises in his eyeballs and like the steam comes out of his ears. And then what happens next is, to me, kind of magical. John Ritter is essentially set loose for a kind of 4-minute comedic aria that is unlike anything I'd ever seen in a sitcom before and kind of unlike anything I've seen since. The idea is that he's now kind of been like fully let loose with the combination of the tranquilizers and the drink. And he goes through this 4-minute sequence, which you really have to watch to appreciate, where he dances through the party. He grabs the old woman and kisses her. There's a very corny joke involving knocking an old man's toupee off. He tap dances on a table. He does an amazing feat of physical comedy where he goes up onto a bar and he's dancing with a martini shaker. He does a kind of remarkable pratfall that involves falling full body behind the bar, not breaking himself at all. And there's a long pause and then this kind of marimba music starts and he comes up from behind the bar with the potted plant on his head like he's Cheetah Rivera and he's shaking the thing. And I have to confess that if I were to make a list of the 10 things in the history of television that made me laugh the hardest the first time I saw them, that would definitely be in the top 10. That moment of him coming up from behind the bar. Now, granted, I was probably about 13 years old, but there's something kind of beautiful about this sequence. And you can tell because it's in front of a live studio audience that the audience is kind of in awe of what's happening. There are, I believe, 4 distinct applause breaks in this 4-minute sequence. And The other thing I love about it is that, you know, it's an example of what you see all too rarely, but which happens kind of in the best episodes of the best TV comedies, where a performer is sort of let loose to be the best version of their comedic self. And through this sequence, John Ritter channels a little bit of Jim Carrey. He channels a little bit of Jack Benny. He channels a little bit of Buster Keaton. And the whole thing is this sort of bravura performance that, of course, ends with a big crash as he jumps onto a piece of furniture and goes off stage and crashes. It's very vaudeville. It's very hokey. It's a little bit reminded me of Singing in the Rain, which I just watched recently for the very first time. But I also think it's kind of magical, and that is what makes this episode stand out in my head. Nothing else of import happens for the rest of it. That's basically the whole show. He comes back. He ends up hooking up with the sister. Janet gets the rich dude that she had her eye on. There's another commercial break. They come back, relay the whole thing to Terry, and there's a corny joke about brain surgery, and then you're out. So in summation, here's what I thought after watching the show. It actually reminded me a lot of the Elaine dancing episode of Seinfeld, in that the rhythm of the episode is very similar. It sort of climaxes in this kind of bravura moment of physical comedy. And I had always heard, you know, I always idolized John Ritter as a kid. And it's funny, as I've been thinking about this episode, I was just today reading this long interview online with Judd Apatow on Vulture.com. And the interviewer asked him at a certain point, was there a comedic performer who you felt never really had the right showcase to shine? And he mentioned working with John Ritter on the Larry Shandling show, and when he was a guest, and being how everyone on the show was just amazed at what a good performer he was and what a great improviser. And, you know, he was on this hit show for years. We kind of forget that Three's Company was an enormous hit. It was like the number two show on TV for several years. It was the number four show during the season that this episode aired. And it made him a huge star, but it also kind of shoehorned him into this role, and he never really had another role in his sort of shortened career that showed him off to his best advantage. But this episode, and specifically, I believe these 4 minutes, really do show him off to his best advantage and is a kind of magical moment of TV comedy. So that is my pitch to you. I present to you Three's Company, Season 6, Up in the Air.
I'll go first.
Shall go first and reply.
Okay. When this started, I was like, oh, not a Suzanne Summers episode. That's weird. And then as soon as it started, Dave said, oh, is this the one where he takes pills and goes crazy? And I'm sure I watched all of Three's Company because it was on in syndication like after school when I was a kid, and it very inappropriately watched it when like I had, I'm sure, no idea most of what was going on. But I didn't remember this one.
Same.
And wow. It's so good. I mean, first of all, I admire the preamble to your presentation. I just want to say you're going with the Kim Reed theory, which is make a canon presentation of something you just feel like watching again. You know, don't worry about the votes. Make it something that's from your heart. She would admire this, I'm sure. I also want to give a shout out to Larry's shirt. If you find this episode on YouTube, which is where we watched it, in his one scene, Larry's shirt is completely amazing, and I would wear it, frankly. It's like a black Aloha shirt with like pink anemones or something. I'm not even sure what they are, but it's amazing. I also like the detail that they have to keep saying tranquilizer because legal was like, you can't say Valium or Quaaludes or whatever it was because they'll get sued. Even having Terry as a nurse give the whole speech about never take medicine that a doctor didn't prescribe to you. Like, yes, yes. Okay. It's the 70s. Like, this is the least of anyone's problems. Someone taking a borrowed sedative. But by the time we get to the main centerpiece, and I can't believe it's only 4 minutes because it feels like the whole episode of his reaction to this drink that he's given, starting with like just his face. Like there's a pause, and then the face he makes after he's downed this drink is amazing. Like we both burst out laughing out loud. It was so great. Me and Dave, obviously, that's who I watched this with. And all of the dancing, I just was wondering, like, what was the script? Like, was it just, you know, 18 pages and then they get to this and then it's like, and then John Ritter just does his thing for 4 minutes. Like it's This is coming at the end of a few multi-cam canon submissions that we have had of late. Barney Miller was another one, and Father Ted, where you really appreciate how much the audience is part of it. And that was, of course, true here. You could never do a sequence like this in a single camera sitcom. You could, but what would be the point? Like, if you don't get that audience feedback in the moment, it would have no life. And so watching him just show off what he can do, like, they, at this point in the series, they must have had a lot of episodes like this. Like, maybe this was just the most memorable, but I have to think that, you know, they understood this far into the series, like, what they had in him as a performer. And that, you know, to come up with scenarios like this where it's like, and then he just goes crazy for 4 minutes. Like, you know, you have to do that when you have a John Ritter. And it was a pleasure to watch. Thank you for bringing it to us. Excellent presentation. Sarah.
When I was a kid, pretty little grade school kid, the rock block of sitcoms that I was watching was I Love Lucy, Brady Bunch, and then Three's Company. And for whatever reason, they only ever aired the Priscilla Barnes Three's Companies. Huh. I don't know why, but like my association with it is like, I almost got up and did the little flamingo pose that she does in the credits because I've seen it so many times. And I feel like Priscilla Barnes and Furley is like the preferred Three's Company, and that Suzanne Summers is now like, her legacy here is like that her character was turned into a verb, meaning that someone got too big for their britches and asked for too much money and got relegated to like phone duty. Anyway, I bring this up partly because the rich guy that Janet is trying to get is my first childhood crush, Mr. Barry Williams, yep, aka Greg Brady, and he's not looking bad. This was not, I just assumed that I was going to vote no for this. This was like Three's Company's kind of everything that I learned to hate about sitcoms from watching it every day. But in the years since being six and an idiot, now I'm 44 and an idiot, but I've seen more of John Ritter's work, and like Sling Blade.
Yeah.
His Buffy episode where he's so brilliant. Like, he played Ben's dad on Felicity, and while that part was like kind of moistly written, he was really good in it. And I feel like his absence is still felt, you know, because he was really underrated and so talented. And I think that sometimes we put things in the canon, but we're really putting like actors in the canon or performances. In this case, I have absolutely no problem with that. This was like Gene Kelly meets parkour, this performance. The face that Tara mentioned, I had in my notes as the Shining face. I like froze it and just laughed at it frozen on my screen for like 10 minutes. And then I just sat around missing John Ritter intensely for a few seconds because it sucks that he's gone. His son has inherited many of his more subtle gifts and looks enough like him that I feel like he's still here. And I hope that we continue to appreciate him because he made a lot of things look really easy. Like, you know, it's no trouble at all. I'm just like falling down onto a mattress. Like, everything about this dance sequence is so flawlessly timed. The look of like, he looks smug when he comes up with the Carmen Miranda like plant thing that he's like, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you know what?
Yep.
You are right.
Mm-hmm.
This was a delight and what a surprise. It was really nice to revisit it. Thank you, Adam. Dave, take us home.
Before Dave breaks in, I would just want to comment on Jason Ritter. Follow him on Twitter because he is also a goof like his dad. Obviously, you can't see physical comedy on Twitter, but he is a huge fan of extremely dumb puns. And if you follow both him and his fiance, the aforementioned Melanie Linsky, you can see a lot of her disgust at said puns, which is cute to observe from a distance. Dave.
Yeah, this is the one episode of Three's Company that I remember. Like, this is, that's, you know, when I saw it as a kid, it stuck in my brain, and I was thinking, you know, the only one I remember is the Tranquilizer Island episode. And sure enough, here we are. And you're right. This is like, you can sell this on, you know, Jack Tripper's little vaudevillian dance number, and you could probably win. So I'm definitely going to vote yes, but I did want to talk about, before we do that, the opening sequence and just the idea that they took the whole cast to the zoo for a day and shot footage for the credit sequence, which begs the question, like, does the building, apartment building, have like an annual outing that all the people go to places?
Why is Furley there?
Yeah, Furley's there, and like Larry's there. Like, it's not just them. It's like the whole fucking building's going to the zoo.
I also had a moment watching the opening, and Jenna Lee Harrison, who played the ill-fated Cindy Snow, the sort of like interregnum character between Suzanne Summers and Priscilla Barnes, was, I guess, still on the show in this season, although they were sort of phasing her out because she was truly quite terrible. I mean, her character was quite bad. That's an interesting case study in like the Coach Woody phenomenon, where you're sort of trying to replace a character with a very mm-hmm. similar character, and sometimes you get the chemistry right, but if they're too similar, it doesn't work. Anyway, she's in that opening sequence too, and as I was watching that sequence, and my heart was sinking a little bit, because I was like, this oh, no. is the opening sequence that like Too Many Cooks is making fun of. Like, whenever you see a parody yeah. of a sitcom opening sequence where people like do a funny face and then freeze, or someone like spills coffee on their lap, This is right at the sweet spot of that. So I was like, this is an ill portent for how well this is going to have aged watching it now, because I had not watched it in a very long time.
And the goes to 11 example of that is Larry getting his picture taken with
an elephant.
You know, he's getting it taken with Janet, and then Janet moves away and there's an elephant there, and he's like kissing or hugging the elephant, as it turns out, because she moved, and he's like, oh, the elephant. And it is so, like, the only thing it was missing was like a freeze frame. Like, that was the only part of that mix.
And doesn't notice until he looks, like, as if the trunk of an elephant yeah. feels the same as the side of Janet's head.
Yeah, we don't know if yeah. maybe Janet doesn't exfoliate. I don't know.
Yeah.
And also, let's have a shout out for Larry's hair.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
It's fantastic. I did spend a couple of seconds thinking about Richard Klein and like, what was Richard Klein's life like in like 1979? Like, he's the star of a hit show.
Yeah.
You know, he's walking around LA, like, he's probably yeah. living up. He's living it up.
If I may quote Jimmy Pardo for a moment, he's swimming in puss.
Yep. Got hot and cold running yeah. trim, no doubt.
Yeah.
All right.
on that note.
Yeah. So
I'm sick. I don't know what the rest of you, your excuses are.
So let's put this to a vote. I am going to vote yes. And I will say that I am perfectly fine. I think, as Sarah also hinted, that I am perfectly fine putting this into the canon for like the last third of this episode. Tari Ariano, what say you?
Yeah, this is, I vote yay as well. This is completely the Judi Dench getting an Oscar for her 6 minutes of Shakespeare in Love, because she should have gotten it for Mrs. Brown. Shout out Joe Reed.
And Sarah D. Bunting.
It's Ritter's show and he makes the most of it. It's a yes from me.
Very good. Company Season 6, Episode 25, Up in the Air. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Who is our winner, Tara?
Well, it's complicated. Deborah Messing is partly our winner because the Will and Grace revival has been renewed for a second season. I mean, however you're going to count it, whatever. I don't know if they're going to call it Will and Grace, the new class, or whatever. It's coming back for a revival this fall. There will be another season after that season in advance of the initial revival season ever airing. But she's also our loser this week. Sarah will have an additional loser because it was announced that Amazon is making a Lucille Ball biopic, and Kate Blanchett is playing Lucille Ball. Burn. And only if you follow Deborah Messing on social media or know anything about her as a redhead in comedy, would you know she idolizes Lucille Ball, and you know that she thought if anyone was making a biopic, it definitely should have been her playing her, and it's not. And because I have complicated feelings about Deborah Messing and her oeuvre, I enjoyed that schadenfreude when the Cate Blanchett project was announced yesterday. So Deborah Messing, mixed bag. Sarah.
Yeah, she and Tori Spelling both crying into their light beers. Yeah. The actual loser is Tim Allen, who is being a fucking baby about his show getting canceled because he alleges the network did not care for his conservative politics. The network, of course, strenuously denied this. Like, first of all, of course, they're not going to admit that if that's the case. And second of all, the other option is that you and your show both sucked. I think we both know what it is. Shut up, Tim Allen. Shut up forever.
Great.
You know what giant corporations like? Money. And you know what they don't care about as much?
Politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking about money, you know what time it is?
Politics time.
It's time for fabulous prizes in game time.
Yay!
Welcome back to Game Time. This is the first game of the season. Today we are playing The Return of Before and After from Dan Casino, who earns himself an extra credit, redeemable for an extra hot, great mini topic of his choosing. Okay, in this game, I will read you the synopsis of a TV show created from the mashup of two separate TV shows whose titles run together. For a point, you give me the mashup title.
Yep.
All right. For example, everyone experiences culture shock when the Connor family picks up stakes and moves to Prince Edward Island.
Roseanne with an E.
Yes. And that would give you 1 point. Make sense?
Yes.
Yep.
All right. Let's throw it to Picky to see our order.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. Our order today is Adam, you're first. Sarah, you're second. Tara,
all right,
you're in third. Are we ready to play The Return of Before and After?
Yes.
Yes.
Here we go. This is for Adam. A very young Michael Douglas goes undercover in a Bay Area high school. And you feel free to talk it out. Weakest Link style.
It's Streets of San Francisco. Twenty-one Jump Streets of San Francisco.
Correct. Good for a point.
Woo.
Ah, yay.
Nice.
A Mountie, this is for Sarah, comes to Los Angeles where he teams up with cops played by Regina King, C. Thomas Howell, and Ben McKenzie.
Of all the people to get this, thanks, Picky. Do Southland?
Do South and Southland. Do Southland. Tara.
Yes.
In this precursor to Adult Swim, a 60s cartoon character and Will Robinson interview minor celebrities.
Lost in Space Ghost? Coast to Coast?
Saved it at the end. Lost in Space Ghost, Coast to Coast. Back to Adam. Archie Bunker really doesn't like this Urkel kid who moved in next door.
All in the Family Matters.
Correct. Sarah, in this Ryan Murphy-produced show, a school guidance counselor convinces a Wisconsin family, led by Scott Patterson, to take in a Pakistani student. They have no idea that this will get them mixed up in the OJ trial.
Wow, that's complicated.
Oh, geez. I don't think I know what the... Would you mind reading it again?
Yeah, I'll read it in a way that kind of... I'll reread it so that I pair up the concepts for you. A high school guidance counselor convinces a Wisconsin family led by Scott Patterson to take in a Pakistani student. They have no idea that this will get them mixed up in the OJ trial in this Ryan Murphy-produced show. Anything?
I mean, American Crime Story, The People versus O.J. Simpson, but the first half, I don't know it.
Tara?
picky. Should have given that one to me. Aliens in America and crime story.
Yes. Gotcha.
Okay, Tara, your second question.
Mm-hmm.
Future detective Carl Urban hates robots, so he quits the police force to be a bodyguard specializing in pretending to be his client in order to catch assassins.
Easy
half. The other half.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Read. Can you read just the after Carl Urban?
Future detective Carl Urban hates robots, so he quits the police force to be a bodyguard specializing in pretending to be his clients in order to catch assassins.
God.
Yeah. I vaguely remember this show. I think it might have been on for a hot minute.
Almost Hugh Man and Machine. I don't know what the other one is.
Almost Human Target. Human Target.
Oh, I would have gone Almost Humantis.
Back to Adam. Andy Cohen interviews amazingly attractive lifeguards and David Hasselhoff in this boozy chat fest.
Sorry, I'm just trying to think of what the Andy Cohen show is called. Watch It Live? Watch It Now? Watch It Live. I'm going to go with Watch It Live. Is it Bay Watch It Live?
You had the right idea, but I didn't have the title. Bay Watch What Happens. Bay Watch What Happens.
Watch What Happens Live.
Yes, Watch What Happens Live. Sarah, he's a washed-up celebrity horse working as a detective. He has just one more question, and then he'll be out of your way.
Colum Bojack Horseman?
Nice.
Stephen Bochco created this misbegotten musical about an LAPD precinct that recruits a moose and squirrel.
Oh, my God. Cop Rocky and Bullwinkle?
Correct.
Hi, Adam Grossworth.
Adam Sternberg, a pun-making ghoul, introduces stories in which anthropomorphic waterfowl might solve a mystery or rewrite history.
Oh, my God.
A pun-making ghoul introduces stories in which anthropomorphic waterfowl might solve a mystery or rewrite history.
There's like five words in that clue that I don't even know what they mean. a pun-making ghoul, anthropomorphic waterfowl. Yeah. Okay, duck, an anthropomorphic waterfowl. It's duck. I got nothing. Howard the Duck. I'm gonna say.
Well,
it's
called Howard. Do you know
Howard
what the other show?
The Duck.
Do you know what the other show is?
About a pun making ghoul.
Yeah, I think that's the key to understanding ghost? This one.
No. A ghost or a demon? No, I got nothing. Elf.
Anybody got know what that one is?
DuckTales from the Crypt.
Do we have Steel Meals, by the way, or no?
You have a Steel Meal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. DuckTales from the Crypt.
I will shut up now.
Sarah D. Bunting, when his wife dies, President Underwood brings his old friends to help him raise his wacky kids.
Full House of Cards.
Robert Wagner and Stephanie Powers star as political aides on opposite sides of the aisle that fall for each other.
Heart to Hearts of Fire.
Yeah. Well done. I don't remember Hearts of Fire at all.
No, me
John
either.
Ritter.
Really?
Marky Post. Mm-hmm. It was the James Carville, Mary Madeline fictionalized sitcom for a minute.
Nicely done. Back to Adam. Marshall, Will, and Holly on a 3-hour tour wind up stranded on a desert island with a bunch of slee stacks.
And Holly on a 3-hour tour, desert island. So it's Gilligan's Island and Land of the Lost. Or Gilligan's Island of the.
Finish saying those last two words. You had it.
Gilligan's Island of the Lost.
Correct. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, space opera in which smugglers at the dawn of the computer age curse in Chinese and the female characters are much more interesting.
And the female characters are much more interesting.
Dawn of the computer age.
Halt and catch Firefly. Space!
All right, bring us into our first score break. Hey, space worked out this time. Or Tara.
Yep.
Long-running NBC soap set in Salem in the 1950s. Maybe this year they'll reveal the mystery of what happened to Chuck Cunningham.
Happy Days of Our Lives.
Correct. All right, that's our first score break. Let's get the scores, please.
Very close game. Sarah and I are tied with 4 each. Adam has 3.
All right, Adam. That music means you are in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. This is how it works. I have in my hand a Trivial Pursuit TV box question card from the mid-80s. I'm going to read you all the questions. If you can get half the questions right, you get 2 points. All right?
Okay.
The card is from the mid-80s. The shows may not necessarily be from the mid-80s. They could be from before that.
All right.
That is correct. Here we go. How many minutes does a bachelorette have to screen candidates on the dating game?
I'm going to go with 3 minutes.
That would be 5 minutes. What honeymooner...
They had longer attention spans back then.
That does seem like a long time, doesn't it?
Yes.
What honeymooner's character gets a job stuffing jelly donuts at Krauss Meyer's Bakery?
I'm going to say it's probably the wife whose name was, I swear, one of these days to the moon. I don't know her name. Lisette.
No, you're right, though. Alice Cramden.
Alice.
All right. What lawman is described in his rather redundant theme song as brave, courageous, and bold? Editorializing
brave,
there by Trivial Pursuit people.
Boy, they could go a lot of ways with this. I feel like it's got to be a Western show. No, I'm going to go in a different way. No. Gunsmoke.
Wow. That had moods. It had layers. It had weather systems. The answer was Wyatt Earp. Wyatt Earp.
Oh, well, I was right about the Western.
You were, until you weren't.
Went away from it.
What I Love Lucy cast member did the House Un-American Activities Committee accuse of being a communist?
It's got to be her husband, Lucy and... not Fred. Lucy and Desi. Desi Arnaz.
Actually, it was Lucille Ball. What? Okay, you can't get it, but let's just get these going. What Idaho resort saw Lucy Ricardo causing Fernando Lamas to break 2 ribs? Idaho resort.
What?
What Idaho resort saw that happen?
Like I'm having a stroke.
The answer.
Idaho resort. Yeah,
you know.
The Tropicana.
Sun Valley. All right, last one. Okay. How many electronic eyes search for dirt on the Jetsons seeing eye vacuum cleaner? How many eyes does a seeing eye vacuum cleaner have?
Well, I feel like it's either 1 or like 1,000. Let's go with 1.
It's 2. Oh, I'm sorry. All right, back to the game, Adam. And we're back to Adam. So here you go. You can get this right. All will be forgiven. Here we go. Detective Jake Stiles ditches William Conrad's DA and gets a new partner. A man who can turn into any animal, but has kind of let himself go.
Oh, okay. Manimal is part of it. Detective Jake Stiles, William Conrad's DNA.
DA, not DNA.
Jake. Oh, it's Jake and the Fat Manimal.
Nice.
Sure
oh,
is.
Yes.
Number 17.
I would watch that show 100%.
In the animated criminal justice system, the people are represented by a Stephen Colbert-voiced guy in a bird costume.
Harvey Birdman, attorney at Law and Order.
Correct. Well done. Tara, sure, it's a black car in the South, but they should know to call him Mr. Kit.
In the Heat of the Knight Rider.
Wow.
Correct. Back to Adam. James Lipton finally gets the chance to interview a fictional late night cast about the Crazy Christian sketch.
Oh, this is so up my alley. The Actors Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
Can you repeat that?
The actor inside the Actors Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
Phew.
Yes.
Susan St. James finally got fed up with Jane Curtin, but her new roommate keeps having vivid hallucinations about dancing babies.
Oh, Jesus. That's aged well. Kate and Allie McBeal.
Correct. Hank is always telling Bobby to be careful out there.
King of the Hill Street Blues.
King of the Hill Street Blues. Yes. Back to Adam. On this CW show, Teddy Savalas plays one of the two boys who will grow up to be president.
Kojak and Bobby.
Robert Culp and Tom Selleck pose as tennis bums to carry out espionage in Hawaii.
Magnum P.I. Spy.
In another example of the Bundy curse, Kelly and Bud wind up being treated by the worst doctor ever, a clown-suited Rob Corddry.
Married with Children's Hospital.
Correct. Deborah Messing, loser and winner of the week, sucks at this revival of a classic game show, but when she screws up in this version, the Hound and a bunch of dragons call her on it.
Game of Thrones. The match Game of Thrones?
Match Game of Thrones. Right. Jerry Van Dyke plays an incompetent Bronx police officer partnered with Fred Gwynne, who finds out that his patrol car is the reincarnation of his dead mother.
Can you read that again, please?
Yeah, sure. Jerry Van Dyke plays an incompetent Bronx police officer partnered with Fred Gwynne, who finds out that his patrol car is a reincarnation of his dead mother.
I think my mother, the car, is half of it, but then I don't know the rest of it. I don't know.
Anybody?
Is it My Mother, the Car, 59, Where Are You?
54, Where Are You?
Oh.
Ooh.
Claire Danes, Tara. Claire Danes plays a modern cop who is somehow sent back into time to solve mysteries in the 70s, while all the while trying to get back to Jordan Catalano in the present.
My so-called life on Mars.
My so-called life on Mars. Correct. And that is our second score break.
Well, I have 8. Adam and Sarah are tied with 7 each.
Oh, okay. So, here's how it's going to work.
Uh-oh.
New rules.
Shit.
You guys get to team up.
Oh, good.
And you get to split the points.
Great.
That's all exciting.
Right? So we get 1 point
here
each.
Here we go. Always innovating here at Game Time. What network did The Late Show premiere on in 1986? The Late Show.
It's CBS, right, Sarah? I'm talking to Sarah right now. I'm not answering. In classic Trivial Pursuit style, we're conferring. It's CBS, right?
We're conferring.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's NBC. About. It's The Late Show with David
Letterman. The Late Show.
Oh. No, it was Late Night with David Letterman.
Yes, I believe it is NBC.
But wait, hold on. Because Late Night with David Letterman was the NBC show, and then they changed it to The Late Show with David Letterman when he went to CBS.
Right, so he didn't go to CBS until 93, so I don't know.
It may have had a different host before, but I think CBS is probably the right... because they must have owned that like property.
I think that's right.
CBS.
This was a mistake. Get this, guys.
I was with you guys.
Yeah, I understand your logic. The Fox Network.
Oh, fuck off, Fox.
That's
what
not even a real thing.
What soap saw Tony Mara Lorna because she wouldn't have an abortion, then divorce her because she did? Oh, that cad. What soap are we talking
That's
about?
All you, sir.
Oh,
Tony Mary Laura. It's got to be General Hospital.
That's Laura or right. Lorna? Dave.
Lorna.
Oh, Lorna.
Like, yeah.
It's got to be specific hospital.
I mean, I feel like it's always Guiding Light, and I never guess that, so
Let's
Guiding
do it.
Light?
Loving.
Oh,
that's not
shit.
A real thing.
My husband was on that show, WAFs.
Oops. What cartoon characters have a law stating everything that can go right will go right? What cartoon cartoon characters? We're talking about a collective name here.
I have no idea. Wonder Twins?
Is it the Justice League of America, that one?
You're on the wrong track. The Smurfs. Oh. The Smurfs. All right, you got to get all three of these. How many Wagon Masters did Wagon Train have? I don't understand any part of that. Lord. How many Wagon Masters?
What do you think a Wagon Master is exactly? The person who drives the wagon or just is the overseer of the wagon operation? Since two was the correct answer for the Jetson vacuum question, I think we should go with two.
I am fine with that.
Hey!
All right, extending this little mini theme here. How many milk bottles are on the Flintstones porch when Fred tries to put out the cat?
It's two or four, right?
Is it? I feel like two sounds... I don't know. You should guess this one because I'm just going to steer us wrong.
Okay. Now I'm doubting myself. Let's go with a single milk bottle.
Hey! Nice!
All right. Got to get this one. Each get a point. What Canines theme song urges, get yourself all set, tune up your TV set?
Could be
the sounds of Brooklyn in the background.
Could be Hong Kong Phooey is the first thing that came to my mind. It's got to be a cartoon, right?
Yeah. The only one I could think of is Underdog, but I don't think that song has words.
It's got to be a cartoon, right? Who are the other cartoon dogs? There's Scooby-Doo. What about Huckleberry Hound?
Oh, yeah, him. I like that idea.
He was Hanna-Barbera, right? Let's go with Huckleberry Hound.
Wow.
That was suspenseful.
Well done. All right, so you each get a point. That means everything's tied up, right?
We're all tied up.
Oh, shit.
Nicely done.
Good work, TV.
All right.
Good work.
Back to Adam. Damon Wayans. Jesus. Is a sitcom dad. His kids include the chicken lady, an Eastern European guy who keeps pretending to crush people's heads.
My wife and kids in the hall.
Listen to the confidence.
A dorkable follow-up to a 90s Disney Channel show that some people liked, apparently.
A
dorkable follow-up to a 90s Disney Channel show that some people liked, apparently.
Oh, God. Hannah Montana, New Girl? I don't know.
New Girl Meets World.
Uh-oh.
New Girl Meets World.
Tara
Ariano. Tom Selleck is the patriarch of a cop family that includes Dennis Franz, Nicholas Turturro, and Kim Delaney.
NYPD Blue Bloods.
Correct. Adam, characters from storybooks escape from 19th century England, and H.G. Wells has to use his time machine to follow them.
So one show is called Once Upon a Time, and I'm going to guess the other one's called Time After Time, and I'm going to say Once Upon a Time After Time.
Wow.
That would be correct. In his latest incarnation, Rowan Atkinson must make a cunning, cunning plan to survive in a woman's prison.
Orange is the New Blackadder?
Yeah.
Nice.
Wow.
Would Red watch. Fox. Red Fox's new get-rich-quick scheme involves storing weapons for Jax, J-A-X, and the rest of Sam Crow. It doesn't go well.
Sanford and Sons of Anarchy.
Holly Hunter plays a hard-drinking cop who has to figure out how to raise her three children alone after divorcing her abusive husband. Sure, it sounds dark, but it's produced by Chuck Lorre, so it'll be a comedy of a sort.
Oh, Holly Hunter. What was the name of that cop show that she was on? I don't remember at all. I keep wanting to say The Closer, but that was the other show with not Holly Hunter on it. With Kim Sedgwick. And her divorced kid's dead. I don't know. I'm going to say come and go lightly.
Anybody? Nope. That's a tough one. Saving Grace Under Fire.
Ah.
Yeah, that was a tough one. Creepy Girl Robot looks back with nostalgia at her childhood in the 1960s.
Creepy
Girl Robot looks back with nostalgia at her childhood in the 60s.
Oh, Jesus. Small wonder years.
Would watch.
That shit ain't right.
All right, Tara, you have to channel your time back at your sister's house for this one, probably. A&E reality show following a Disney princess in training as she tries to solve murders within the crucial first 2 days.
Sophia, the first 48?
Yeah.
Nice. Bunsy approves.
Swatch wearing teen who's legally not Ferris Bueller moves to Colorado where he has to deal with foul mouthed kids.
Oh, Parker something. Oh, okay. So it's South Parker. What's that show called? I remember that show too. That Ferris. It was kind of the Ozark to the Breaking Bad of Ferris Bueller.
Sure. Featuring the Coob.
I'm not going to remember it. South Parker Bidwell.
Steel meal.
Totally on the right track.
Steel meal.
All right, here we go.
South Parker Lewis can't lose.
Yeah, she did.
Nice.
All right. So now we're all out of steel meals, right?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
I have my official list is not near me.
That's how you use a steel meal.
Good job, Sarah.
Thanks.
Sarah, there's a laugh track, but not much comedy in this Aaron Sorkin show about a judge overseeing wacky crimes after hours.
Sports Night Court?
Yeah.
Correct. All right, bring us into our next score break. We're getting towards the end. Look, it doesn't make sense for a red-clad secret agent to steal world landmarks when the whole show is being imagined by an autistic child.
Oh, no. Is it The Saint Elsewhere?
Oh, I have a guess. Nope.
It isn't?
Is it Saint Elsewhere in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Oh!
Yes. Holy shit. I really thought it was The Saint Elsewhere, too.
Nice work, Adam. Okay, Sarah's in the lead with 12. I have 11. Adam has 10.
Ooh.
All right, Adam. If you can manage this, you'll be in a tie for the lead.
Good luck, Adam.
Who wanted all his stall furnished? What? Oh, I see. Who wanted his stall furnished in Chinese modern?
Oh my lord! There's not more clue.
Who wanted his stall furnished in Chinese modern?
Oh man. Stall suggests maybe it's Mr. Ed. But I have no idea what Chinese modern means, so I will humbly decline to answer.
Well, say something. Maybe something you've already said.
Mr. Ed. That's the answer?
Take the W.
Don't second guess yourself.
Especially don't not answer. Who have Sue Ellen Ewing, Afton Cooper, and Marlee Stone all had sex with?
Don't say you.
Don't say your mom.
Who are three people that have never been in my kitchen?
Wait, is this one for me again?
They're
all for you.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that? Who have Marlene Stone?
Pay attention. Who have Sue Ellen Ewing, Afton Cooper, and Marlee Stone all had sex with?
Bobby Ewing.
JR.
JR. Okay.
Which of the lookalikes on the Patty Duke show has lived most everywhere? You know.
I have no idea. Mr. Ed.
Yeah, close. Kathy Lane.
Benson.
What I Love Lucy cast member was 41 years old when the show premiered?
I'm going to say Lucille Ball.
Yay!
Correct. All right. You need one of these last two. What spaced out cartoon was the first ABC show to be aired in color?
The Jetsons.
Correct.
Nice.
Get it.
For shits and giggles, what brand of margarine does Patrick Duffy plug?
Oh,
Big margarine got to Patrick Duffy.
Patrick Duffy, I'm thinking back to margarine. I mean, the only, what brands of margarine are there? I'm going to say Basel.
Parquet.
Oh, Basel was only Canadian.
Yeah, Parquet. But now nice you're work. In the tie for
yes.
first.
Well done.
Everybody has...
Yes, tie for first with Sarah.
Two questions left.
Oh, shit.
So here we go. Adam Sternberg, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Tony Danza works as the housekeeper for William Shatner's law firm, and as much as they'd like to deny it, sparks will fly.
Who's the Boston Legal?
Correct. Sarah.
Yep.
Tom Bosley plays a Catholic priest in Chicago trying to figure out how Mom Cop, that's in quotes, stayed on the air for two seasons.
How Mom Cop stayed on the air for two seasons. I mean, sadly, I know the Tom Bosley part. Sure. I'm just trying to figure out
Sarah loves
it's
her
Father Dowling Mysteries of Laura.
Yeah.
Oh, whoa. Deborah Messing, you're a winner in my heart for now.
Wow. All right, Tara.
Yep.
Baloo the Bear runs an air freight delivery service for Mayor Barry Boswick.
Oh, Tailspin City.
Nice.
Tailspin nice. City. All right. So scores have remained the same.
Correct. Well, they're 13-13-12 for me in the trailing behind.
Relative.
Yes.
Relative.
Yes.
What I meant. All right.
Ooh, good luck, everybody. Okay.
Are you ready, Adam?
I'm ready.
Now, there were one question short, so I had to add one. And this is a little, the hint's a little different, but I still quite get it.
Wait a second. Right? Okay. Fine.
I mean, different format. San Francisco zombie cocksucker. San Francisco zombie cocksucker.
Okay, hold on. San Francisco The Walking Dead, San Francisco.
Now, because it's a quote, I didn't want to do it, but you have to. I should have done it in a Chinese accent.
And sadly, that doesn't help me very much. It's a quote from a show, San Francisco Zombie Cocksucker. It's
an interesting quote.
You
got The Walking Dead.
The Walking. I mean, okay, so San Francisco. The Walking. Dead of the night, The Walking. Something.
We're gonna need an answer.
The Walking Deadline.
Dead.
Switching.
Oh,
I watched that show.
Oh, I did.
The
yes.
Walking Deadwood.
Yes. But why would okay, I guess the Chinese character on the show
that's what
say
he says.
That about himself. Yes.
That's what Mr. Wu says about the people in San Francisco.
That's right. All right. Fair enough. Totally.
Okay. Woo. All right. So, Sarah D. Bunting, are you ready?
Not really, but let's proceed.
Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Deborah Messing are brought together after their husbands all announce they're in love and planning to get married.
Wow. It's really that simple. All right. Will and Grace and Frankie.
Nice.
Correct. So what's the scores right now?
I can't win. Sarah just won. Sarah just clinched it with 14.
Oh, okay. So here's your last question, Tara.
Way to go, Sarah.
Thank you.
Secret Service agent Robert Conrad and his acronistic gadgets have a new assignment protecting President Martin Sheen.
Is this Wild Wild West Wing?
It is.
Wow, nice.
Well done.
Congratulations.
Sarah, with the win.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to put a steel mill up for grabs with the shits and giggles question.
Okay.
First person to shout out the answer after I have completed the clue will win the steel mill. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tubbs and Crockett trace a drug shipment to dangerous Alaska and Yukon routes run by a rare breed of drivers with nerves of steel.
Miami Vice Road Truckers.
Oh, I think Sarah got that one.
I'm
going to
give it to Sarah.
Yeah.
She was faster than me.
Sarah.
That was Miami Vice Road Truckers. Well
and I replenished
done.
My steel meal. It's been quite an afternoon.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We put on our DEET and got together for Wet Hot American Summer Camp Reunion season before going around the dial with stops at The Sinner, Ozark, Intervention, and Future Cop. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time. Oh, also in between those two things, the canon, which was accepted because I forgot to write it down because I'm dumb. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
you're 26. It should look like an old catcher's mitt.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Chrissy, you just missed her.
And Adam Sternberg.
I can breathe!
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
Sorry, I have to be going.
No, please, no!
Sorry you can't candle stick around.
And don't list us as a reference.
And we'll take our keys back now.
And no, you can't help yourself to anything in the kitchen.
And guess what? We won't be home by 11.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.